Okay, Joe, we're back. This is cool. What, episode two, or I think, I don't know. What do you call that? The first one was episode zero, I think.
You like to number things that way.
Well, but the first one was just an introduction to the class. Saying, yeah. Hey, welcome to the class. It was
so
like
not
3 minutes.
Really a substantive session.
Nah, this is just the second the second of our big discussions together.
Right.
Although maybe like the 300th, but you know, between us, like, you know,
that's fair.
Yeah. Just, you know,
and all at different times and spliced together. And
the timeline is all,
you know, it's the world is just this big pudding with raisins in it.
Well, at the outset, you know, there's this case, right? This, it's a contracts case. I think we should clarify, this is just preliminary. This is just like, let's just read a case. Right. So we're going to discuss, beginning next week, like legal argument in a more systematic way, contract law and the issue, you know, what makes a contract. We're going to come back to that later in a more detailed, substantive way.
Different fields of law.
Right. Interpretation, right? The kinds of reasons that courts give. We're going to continue to study this. So I say this at the outset because I don't feel like the student should feel like they have to have complete mastery of this case and every, you know, every definition in it and every legal term of art. I mean, it's a matter of kind of gradually becoming more familiar with law talk.
Yeah. And dipping your toe in.
Yeah.
And I think it's a very fun and interesting and easy to grasp scenario.
Yeah.
So after it's
you
good
get
for that.
After you get past a few maybe procedural things, the actual issue is pretty direct and enticing. It's an interesting thing to think about, I think, which is why we chose
question.
It. Yeah. Okay. No. What else was I going to say about this? That I said this is preliminary, and that's a little bit on the nose because it's about a preliminary injunction.
That is so.
And the last section and what we're going to talk about in class in the live lecture session is this idea of the litigation train, you know, you're starting with a complaint and before that, even some fight dispute between parties.
Right.
And ending with the denial of all appeals and potentially. Yeah. And there are lots of stops along the tracks of the litigation train, lots of off ramps. And the preliminary injunction is kind of an interesting one because it happens early on and
it does.
It's like a remedy that can happen even before judgment.
Yep. You've got a plaintiff in effect saying, you know, can't wait, won't wait, need help now.
Right.
And I can make clear enough to you, even without the benefit of seeing all the terrain we see on that long train ride, right?
Yeah.
I can make clear to you that I'm going to be right in the end.
And you have to have, I think a legal system really needs a mechanism like this.
For sure.
You can imagine people fighting over whether a dam is legal. And I happen to have a home or own land that will be flooded by the dam. It seems to be a very important, you know, question whether to build the dam. And because once the dam is built, my land is going to be flooded.
Right.
It seems like maybe until we determine that it's legal, we should hold off on flooding the land. So there are going to be scenarios like that where you just can't unwind what is about to happen. And we really should resolve the legal dispute before allowing this kind of change in the status quo.
And again, when the person who is bringing that complaint to the court can make clear that this is almost surely to be a mistake, what this other person wants to do, then you have all the more reason to say, well, yeah, let's keep things where they are right now. Let's keep the status quo in place.
Yeah.
or let's, you know, move things in the direction you say they need to be moved to protect your interests, because a preliminary injunction could actually change the status quo, it needing to preserve it.
Right.
You know, if you're kind of that on the money with your argument and your evidence, then hey, yeah, that makes sense. That letting this go ahead or failing to take this step really would be harmful.
Yeah.
Well, but you've got to be able to show that, right?
So the
merit in your argument is very much part of how this remedy makes sense.
Yeah, and I introduce it here at the outset of our conversation because I think our effort here was to have a case that was kind of somewhat simple to grasp, and we could just kind of talk about and start talking about legal argument as we kind of move into the into the more substantive parts of the course in later weeks. And here's a little wrinkle. Like, it's a little bit more complicated than just a straight ahead. I say this as plaintiff, you say that as defendant, and the judge declares who wins the case at the end, right? This is a preliminary thing, and so there's a little bit of a standard. So it's a little wrinkle. I think the other wrinkle here is this is a case in which we have an intervening party, the Qdoba, right?
Yep.
And they are neither a plaintiff nor a defendant, but somehow through procedures in the state, and I'm not familiar with what the intervention procedures are in the state, but most states in the federal system allow, I say most, all surely, right, allow parties whose rights would somehow be impacted significantly by the litigation to kind of join in and make arguments, right? And they are intervening parties. And so Qdoba, or at least the company which would run the franchise, is now part of this case, because obviously it's pretty clear, right, that if they lose the case, they can't open their restaurant. So they have a direct stake in this litigation.
Exactly.
And so they should be invited to join in and make arguments and be able to talk about why they should be allowed to move into this. So that's another little wrinkle. It's not the strict, like, plaintiff, defendant, let's move along the litigation train until we get to a judgment. And so I just wanted to raise that at the outside too.
Cool.
Outset.
Yes.
Yes. We got to make sure this is right. What do you want to talk about next? So I've got some notes here, but you've got some ideas too.
Yes. And I haven't seen your notes, but it seems to me that it's helpful to make sure that you have a good sense for the factual setting that people are involved in.
Yeah.
How they find themselves there. And the reason that's helpful is because the person who they're asking to assist them in resolving this dispute, the judge, the court, right, wants to do a good job of resolving the dispute they really have and resolving it as well as possible under the circumstances. So it's good for us as readers who are trying to understand it to make sure we've thought a little bit about, and sometimes it's not said by the court itself. Sometimes it's sort of background understanding about what's going on to understand what is a situation like this all about, or at least what is it a little bit about? What can I understand? Just kind of using common sense and experience and thinking about things like, what would a contract between a landlord and a tenant for a business space, what would the interests of the two people involved in that be like? What kind of things do we think landlords want who are running shopping centers? What kind of things do we think businesses who are going to be tenants in that shopping center, what kind of things do they want? When do their interests point in the same direction? When do they point in different directions?
Yeah.
And if we ask ourselves questions like that, I think our reading of what we're seeing is going to be much more interesting and informative. So I thought we should do that.
Yeah, this is my first day of law school. The professor who ended up being my most important mentor, I think, in law school, and the most important influence on my thinking. You know, there were several professors giving little bits of advice about law school, right? So it's that kind of like orientation, kind of thing. And his was, make the easy cases hard.
Mm.
And he didn't mean, like, you know, learn lawyers' tricks, you know, to engage in sophistry and turn what everybody knows into something which is like people are skeptical about for no reason.
Right.
I think what he meant is what you're pointing to, that people who are, you know, what comes to us as lawyers and in courts are disputes.
Yes.
Right? No disputes, no cases.
Right.
Right. And why are people having these disputes? I mean, if they're having disputes, they obviously are disagreeing.
Right.
Human beings have interests, they have reasons, and when those reasons and interests conflict, you get disputes, and sometimes the parties can't settle it themselves.
Right.
Some things like
that in life and in law too, I imagine, we literally have a phrase for this, right? Agree to disagree.
Right.
You can actually decide that the thing you don't agree on isn't important enough to keep worrying over that fact.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, you and I wouldn't know this because we don't disagree on anything, do we, Joe?
And so when you're in a court dispute, when you're in a legal dispute in court, what you have are people who can't just agree to disagree.
Right.
They're disagreeing at a level that requires them both, they think, to get this third independent person, the judge, to give an answer.
And if you're training to be that person, or if you, you know, a lot of students in this class maybe don't want to go to law school and don't want to be lawyers, but just to understand the business of the rule of law, the business end of the rule of law.
Exactly.
I think it's important to know what kinds of considerations a person in that role ought to have, and the lawyers assisting their clients ought to have.
Yeah.
Which I think is a to make the easy cases hard, or really to understand why are these people fighting, you know, why is there this dispute, requires, I think, a certain habit of mind. And I am going to emphasize this in class over the course of the semester. It's like, you know, there's a certain habit of mind which is generative and productive in legal settings, and maybe in thinking about disputes more generally in society. Because I think one reflex people might have when they see a fight is to ask, who's the good guy, who's the bad guy, right? Who's the person who's right, and who's the person who's wrong? And maybe in our society, this comes up a lot, right? Who do I agree with? Who do I disagree with? That sort of thing, right?
Yeah.
And before, you know, indulging maybe that reflex, I think engaging in some amount of intellectual empathy, which is an attempt to say, okay, if I were the landlord in this case, like, what would I be thinking? Like, what would be my reasons? And we can never do that perfectly, right? And this is why we bring in lots of evidence in law and everything, right?
Right.
In order to get better information about, like, well, what are the factors that bear here? And then we look at what the law says, right, about this. But I think the first step is understanding why people are fighting at as deep a level as you can.
Yeah.
But I also think you can engage in this habit of mind in all kinds of other ways. Like, if we were to talk about what our favorite movie is, and you say that my favorite movie is terrible, we could either be at an impasse and agree to disagree, or we could try to engage with one another more deeply to figure out, well, what is it, you know, that is making me love this thing and you hate this thing, right?
Sure.
And to be really productive about that involves my trying to say, okay, well, how does Joe see this? And you would say, well, how is Christian seeing this?
Yeah. And it's interesting because one thing that we, even if we were disagreeing about that thing, that movie question that you just raised, for example.
Right.
One thing we're definitely agreeing about, and you can tell because we're having a conversation, is that we should be conversing about it.
Right.
That's really interesting. Right?
Rather than fighting.
Yeah.
Right.
Like the litigants here agree very much that getting this court's help is the right way to move forward.
Right.
So even though they disagree about something, what's the meaning and scope of a part of their agreement? They agree profoundly that this is the place they should go to get an answer to that question. That's really important to see.
Right, rather than, right? Say Qdoba just moving into the mall, and then maybe they show up and they have a duel, or they fight, or
right,
or even someone, they just call each other names.
Right,
and
someone pushes over stuff or cuts the you know, the brake cable on the backhoe that's moving construction equipment. I mean, all kinds of crazy stuff, right? That, like, that's not what we're doing.
Right.
At least not in this instance.
Right. Right?
So disagreements, it's good to, I think, appreciate that disagreements can take place in a way that suggests that there's a broader context about which the people who are disagreeing about agree about a lot of stuff that's really important.
Yeah.
And like, let's have our disagreement this way, not that way.
I can tell you, you know, as a practicing lawyer too, I thought some of the most interesting experiences I had as a practicing lawyer were, like, the initial phases around the table when the case first came in, throwing out ideas. And there are sometimes people who I think over-identify with the client's point of view. And that's a time, that early time is a time to understand what makes this case hard. Like, why is the other side saying what they're saying?
Right.
I think only then can you kind of feel what it's going to be like to be the judge presented with these conflicting views, if the judge is a good judge.
Yeah.
And then that sense of all these interests that you identify, that sense of, like, why people are agreeing to disagree, I think then when you go and you read the law, whether it's in the statutes or it's in the cases or it's in the administrative regulations, I always think there's a story that the law is really trying to tell. And that it helps to have a sense of the meat and of this conflict, in order to read that story, to see how that story interacts with this case.
So should we dig in a little bit on the landlord-tenant thing in particular?
Sure.
Like, I can just spend, like, I could share with you my thoughts about how I would think about that.
Yeah, yeah, go ahead.
Come to this,
yeah,
and I think
to be more specific about it.
Yeah,
yeah.
I think I would, and this isn't to suggest that other people might not look at it in other really interesting ways. The way it strikes me is, I think, okay, why do they have this agreement, this contract, this lease? And you read early in the opinion that it's an agreement about something that's going to last for 5 years.
Right.
That's a long time. I can't remember things from 5 days ago, much less 5 years ago. Right. So if I really want to remember something, it's good to write it down because it's a good way to make sure that you could go back and look at it again.
Right.
If you didn't remember what it was. And the writing is the evidence about what you guys agreed on in this context, right? We've both got to agree to this language for it to be in the contract.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of what making it a contract means. So writing it down is good. It's a long-term relationship. And now I'm asking myself, okay, what's this relationship, this business relationship, and who wants what? I think the landlord wants the shopping center to be as successful as possible financially. And the best way to make sure that of that is for the landlord to have the most freedom to make whatever choices the landlord makes about who his tenants are with the freshest information.
Right.
Full landlord choice about which tenant to rent to based on what's happening today. Not last year, now, right? What's the tenant's interest? Well, I want it to be a really successful shopping center too. So I want my landlord to be able to rent to lots of other businesses,
right?
Because those customers will come and use my business, right?
Right.
So here we're lined up. But I don't want a business just like mine to be right next to me at the shopping center. Why? Because competition is going to make it harder for me to make my buck that I'm trying to make here relative to that not being present. And that's when you read in the case, say, this is the person who asked for the quote exclusivity. Right.
Right. Right.
It's the restaurant that said, can we limit the kind of restaurants you can rent to? And the landlord, you can tell because it's in the agreement, the landlord didn't just say, no, I need maximum flexibility. And if you can't do that for me, you can't rent from me. Right.
Right.
That's a thing that might have happened for some other kind of business or some other kind of landlord. Right. But here, the landlord was like, oh yeah, I see your point. If we can hammer something out, great. Okay, well now here we are. We're going to hammer it out and we're going to write it down so we remember, right?
Right.
And in that context, people using words, right? They're trying to build a future out of words. Okay, these are the words we chose. And again, they're not in there unless we both agreed to them. So you can't just willy-nilly later on say, well, let's use a different word.
And I think it's important here to emphasize
is
that,
this helping?
Yeah, no, it really is. I just want to emphasize a couple of things. One we'll come back to at the end maybe, but one is that the entering, you know, a contract is as much a law, at least for the parties, as a statute or a bit of common law. It's another source of law. And we'll talk about these again later in the semester, right?
Yeah.
So for, as far as the parties are concerned, this is like a statute passed by the legislature. It will be binding to them.
Yeah.
And but the parties, you know, irrespective of the law, the parties are hoping to do something together.
Yes.
That they can't accomplish alone.
Right.
Right. Which is the nature of our human condition, right? That we are social creatures and we are capable of doing things together that we are not possible. We aren't capable of doing alone. Right.
Yeah.
And to do things together that involve some investment, right? That involve like some of my life energy, maybe some of my capital, some, you know, it puts me in a position of vulnerability as to you, right? If we do things together, right? And so parties who cooperate are making themselves mutually vulnerable to one another.
Interdependent, yeah.
And one thing that the law can do is to give the parties tools to talk about those vulnerabilities, to talk about that interdependence, right? And to structure it. And the state gets behind them and says, you know what, if you have an agreement like this and you put it in a form like this and the forms allowed have changed over times and places, but are generally pretty liberal in terms of what can constitute an enforceable agreement.
Sure.
The state says, we'll stand behind you. So that if you structure this mutually vulnerable situation between the two of you, hoping to do more together than you could have alone, and one of you kind of tries to run off or renege on the deal, we'll come in and we'll make them comply, just as if they had maybe violated a statute or something like that. And
it makes this form of cooperating, therefore, much more valuable.
Right.
Because people understand that they'll get the help of the community in the form of law in court to help them make that commitment real.
And to just to, you know, your story about the interests of the parties, I think is a good one. And it shows it doesn't really, like you can tell that story without law at all. The two parties want to get together and cooperate and say, okay, if we're going to, you know, if you're going to come in and build something in my building,
right.
Here's how much I'm going to charge you because, you know, this is what I'm expecting to get out of this. And I put a bunch of money into building this thing. And well, that sounds great. I needed a place to go. But this is only going to work for me if you do these things, you know, you provide right. certain infrastructure and maybe you don't allow in a certain amount of competition because I've modeled how much I'm going to make. And
right.
so, and of course, from the perspective of the landlord, right. It's yes, they would like maximum flexibility, of course. But in some ways, they like don't expect that because they know that to create something which is more than the sum of its parts,
yeah.
right? They're going to have to offer something. You know, ideally, they would just have a plot of land and they wouldn't have to build a building at all. And Qdobo would come in and just sell maybe out of the back of a van or something like that. And they don't have to. But they know that if they build the building. Right. That's more conducive to the kinds of businesses sure. they write. So
when the landlord yeah. says yes in response to the Panera franchisee request, hey, I need an exclusivity clause, the landlord is saying yes for really good reasons.
Yes. And reasons which are good for the landlord ultimately.
This, of course.
Because that's what creates the gains of trade, as they say, like the increase over what we each bring to the table alone.
Yep.
So
and importantly, yeah. I think We've also, an implication of what we've said is that if you think about it, you know already, it's definitely going to affect the price of the lease.
Right.
That's really important, actually, because this is another reason why you wouldn't want to kind of recklessly go in there and start changing things. Because the price that they agreed on is built out of things like, I got this exclusivity from you, landlord, and I got from tenant from you that your exclusivity is this way, not this other way.
Right, right, right.
Right. So that it's sort of into the lease price is built all these things.
Mm-hmm.
That's important.
And, you know, it's not just price. It's also the nature of the building and all the other. All of it together is what, you know, this makes sense for me. You know, I've modeled out what I can do as a Panera in terms of, you know, making money. And in terms of experience and how it adds to my brand, you know, there could even be a Panera which wants to open somewhere, which Panera knows will lose money, yeah. but will contribute overall to its brand. And right. So it can be a loss leader store. Right. So the calculations of the individual parties can actually be quite complicated.
Sure.
And what they're looking for from each other is something which advances their interest, but their interest together. Maybe I enter a deal with you that I know will lose money because I'm interested in business with you in the long run.
But, yeah.
And this is a good, so, all of these things, they can be quite complicated, I think, to figure out.
Yes.
In a given case.
And you have no chance of figuring it out if you don't ask yourself these questions.
Right.
Right. You need to start to think through what's the situation in which we find ourselves. Where do they find themselves?
Well, what else did you have on your list? I mean, so we're thinking about the party's interests and we're thinking that through.
I mean, there are things about the opinion. Do we want to talk about...
You talk about the contract and then the way that... should we just get right to the meat of whether a burrito is a sandwich?
Meat.
Yeah, well. Yeah.
I don't know that we should do that. I do want to talk about these dictionary ideas that I've got if you think it's a good thing to do. Do you think that's a good thing to do?
I think so. I want to... So I think one thing I want to emphasize in the podcast that I don't know that I emphasized in the textbook that we, is the importance of focusing on the language of the contract. You know, if there's a statute, if there's a bit of common law from a case with a holding in it, if there is a contract and the question is, what does this mean? Right. Well, you know, there's lots of interesting thinking that you can do about meanings of things, and we're going to get into that in the class, right? But start by reading the thing, right? Yes. Start by reading the here the contract provisions, and there was an amendment to the contract, right? And
another great sign that people can agree to agree, like they agreed to the language in the first place. Then they agreed to change the language in some respects that don't bear on this dispute, right?
Right.
This part, the thing they're fighting about, stayed the same. But other things about it changed. Well, that's really interesting.
And I think it's maybe certain stores they expected to open didn't open, but other ones were going to, and it's okay. You can allow this Papagino's, but you know, we're not going to.
So you can amend a contract. They did.
Yeah. And I think maybe another important thing to say here is that, should we talk about let me just say about the preliminary injunction, right? So again, we're not at the end of the case, and ultimately at the end of the case, we would decide, well, can they build this, can they lease to this Qdoba? And it's going to depend on whether or not doing so would violate the lease agreement.
Right.
They might be allowed to do it and just have to pay damages. I mean, that's another question of remedy, but the question is ultimately it's going to be, does this Qdoba lease violate the lease agreement with the Panera,
right,
with PR? And so that's where we're going to get ultimately. We're not there yet. And instead we're asking whether that whole agreement with Qdoba needs to be put on hold until the litigation completes. And that's the preliminary injunction idea. And to get a preliminary injunction, the court says you got to show four things, right? You have to show a substantial likelihood of success on the merits, a substantial risk of irreparable harm. And then if you can show those, you have to show that the balance of harms would favor the person who wants the preliminary injunction, meaning that they would be harmed more than the other person would be harmed. And that and you would also have to consider the impact on the public interest more broadly. So you have to show all of those things. And when you see legal standards, and we'll talk a lot more about this in class, when the students see this either in a statute or in a case, in other words, to win or to prove this, you need to show these things, A, B, and C. Pay attention to whether it's A, B, and C, or A, B, or C, or whether the test is, you know, weigh A, B, and C to see what should happen. Again, we're going to talk more about this over the course of the semester, but this is one of those cases where in order to get what the party wants, what the moving party wants, which is PR in this case, they have to show each of four things.
Yes.
One of those is a substantial likelihood of success on the merits, which means, are they likely to win this case? Which means, well, let's actually look at what the law is that applies here, and let's consider what we would do if we were actually deciding this case finally,
yeah,
and figuring out how confident are we that ultimately they'll win this case. So we end up kind of getting a peek at the merits.
Yes.
And by the merits, we mean the actual application of the law to the facts in this case in a way that would resolve it.
Right.
And so that's how we get to way before trial, even before summary judgment. That's how we get to deciding whether a burrito is a sandwich in the context of this particular contract.
Right.
So all that is, I think, if you've never studied law before, it's maybe useful to remind ourselves again where we are in the litigation train, why we're looking at the merits now. All of this matters because the court could decide to deny the preliminary injunction here, even if it thinks, you know, I think ultimately PR is likely to lose or likely to win, right? It's a substantial, they have to show a substantial likelihood of success on the merits. They have to show a balance of harms. They have to show irreparable harm. I don't think they show any of that. We can talk about that, but the court doesn't think that they do. The likelihood on the merits is a different question. It's interesting. We'll again talk about that, but this is not like the final judgment in a case, and yet it allows us to peek at what that might be.
And indeed, it's such a powerful glimpse at what that might be,
mm-hmm,
that after the ruling happens, one of the things that both parties are thinking about is, do we want to keep doing this or not?
Right.
It might be time to stop litigating and start getting on with the new world in which they find themselves.
And this is one of the questions that we left with the students in the book, right? You know, what would you do next? And one thing you might be able to do unusually before the end of a case is appeal.
Yes. And whatever you do, I think you have a lot more information now than you did the moment before this thing issued.
Right.
The moment before the opinion issued, you didn't yet know what informed, qualified, I'm making assumptions here, but an informed, qualified judge makes of these arguments.
Yeah.
Taking a hard look at them and explaining both what the conclusion is and why. Well, now you have that document in front of you that you have a lot more information. Both of you do.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting because now you can make more decisions.
And what, we're going to return to this in a couple of weeks. I mean, one thing that I think beginning law students and maybe members of the public more broadly think is when you see a legal opinion or you see something decided, it's always a narrative. So it has that kind of structure of a beginning, middle, and end.
Yeah.
And so they read it and they say, oh, well, so-and-so won or so-and-so lost the case. I think it's important like right away to view any ruling, even a final judgment, as one event in the stream of events, and stuff happened before that opinion, yep. Stuff will happen after that opinion.
Yes.
And what the opinion does is it changes what might happen after. It gives parties like different incentives, different requirements, different things, but it's never certain. So you can win a lawsuit and yet lose in some ways. And we will see that in a couple of weeks. For now, I think this preliminary injunction, while it doesn't finally resolve the case, is certainly a major event in the stream of events as it relates to this dispute.
Absolutely.
Now, so the question is a burrito a sandwich? The contract says, what does it say? No sandwich shops. I've got the text here. I'm not going to read all the text. The students have the text in front of them.
The word sandwich is a key part of determining who can't get a lease from this landlord anymore.
Right. For a bakery or restaurant reasonably expected to have annual sales of sandwiches greater than 10% of its total sales, or primarily for the sale of high quality coffees or teas, such as et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
And there's some other things in there. You know, if we were really analyzing this, we would look at the specific things they allowed. We would ask, well, why did they allow that? And do they think of that as different from sandwiches? And we would try to infer from the whole contract what the parties likely meant by sandwiches. And why do you think it's important to try to, when we read this, to think about what the parties meant by sandwiches or what the word sandwiches means in the abstract, Joe?
Oh, I think it's important to think about what the parties meant. Of course, the fact that they chose those words could turn on lots of things. But those are the words they chose. And again, you think about why write anything down at all? Because it's going to be a multi-year thing,
mm-hmm.
and we want to understand what we've agreed to, and we want to remember it, so we write it down so that we could understand, and that means we need to choose the words with which we wrote it down. So this is like, it is what we agreed to.
So if the parties were clear that they thought sandwich included lasagna, salads, Coca-Cola,
yeah,
right? Then it wouldn't bother you that that is a very unorthodox use of the word sandwich.
It wouldn't bother me. I will say though that the way to persuade me that they really did think what you just said, that that sandwich included those things, those are not, as you just said, that's not usually what the word sandwich refers to.
Right.
And so I would want to see really good evidence that something so atypical was what they had in mind is the scope of that word.
And reliable evidence. So maybe not like, well, you know, in the course of negotiations, they, you know, the so-and-so said, of course, sandwiches also means Coca-Cola. Like that would be evidence that's kind of extraneous or extrinsic to the contract. But if the contract included a definition section, it says sandwiches, by sandwiches here, we the parties mean
right.
Coca-Cola, salad, lasagna, and pretty much everything else.
And let me come at it from the other end. If maybe now you think you're trying to sort of future-proof this thing against problems, right?
Right.
You say, hey, we think sandwich, we've got kind of a funky definition of this, right? And we know that. What problem do we not want to have later? Disagreeing about this, the atypical scope. So mm-hmm. let's not just write down the word sandwich. Let's write a definition for the word sandwich.
Right.
Because we're using it in a somewhat different way. So you could actually see why it would make sense to people to do what you just said.
Yeah.
Have a definition section that includes sandwich means, right? For purposes of this contract, sandwich means the following.
But when you just said that, you mentioned that the parties were conscious of the fact that they were using it, I think in your words, in a different way or in a somewhat different way. And if they weren't doing that,
that would make it more likely that you would see that definition.
That's right.
Section.
That's right. And what I'm wondering is, because we don't see that special definition, do you think dictionaries are particularly relevant to understanding what the parties meant here?
They could be because you could ask yourself, okay, it, they didn't appear to mean something atypical. How do you know that? Because there's not a special definition. All right. So does that suggest they meant something typical? Yeah. Okay, where do I find out what that is? Because they're both in front of me right now disagreeing about what it means.
Right.
If they weren't disagreeing about what it means, I wouldn't need to worry about this. But here they are. So how would I know it's the typical version, not the unusual version?
Mm-hmm.
Where do we find that? Well, I mean, you could just think to yourself, well, here's what I would mean if I use the word sandwich. Okay, you're not a party to this. Like, you weren't part of those conversations. Maybe you don't run this kind of business. Maybe, you know, maybe you think, well, I mean, I have some experiences of the word sandwich, but maybe there's more to the word sandwich than I really understand or know. So I could just
and these are parties,
myself, right?
These or are I parties could, in the food industry, or at least landlords renting to people in the food industry.
Yeah. So you could find yourself thinking, well, it'd be awfully nice to have just some way to do a kind of a check
mm-hmm.
on. So what would a typical scope for this word be? A typical meaning as opposed to an unusual meaning, right? So the answer, one answer to that might be a dictionary. And of course, that to me raises more questions about, okay, which one?
Because you're a bit of a dictionary scholar.
I wouldn't say a scholar.
You've written an article though.
Yeah, but I'm not a lexicographer. That's the professional name you give someone who writes dictionary definitions, mm-hmm. who makes dictionaries. It's, mm-hmm. It takes a lot of learning and skill. I'm not that. I'm also not a lexicographerologist. Like, I don't study lexicographers.
Oh my gosh. We're getting really meta here.
Yeah.
But I have
a keen appreciation for the complexity that is the dictionary tradition.
Enough of an appreciation such that if I say, well, let's just look this up in the dictionary.
Oh boy. I got a big problem because you've conveyed so much about what you don't understand because you said the,
yeah,
not
right.
Dictionary.
Right.
And it's like, then I'm like, oh, this is bad.
All right. So let me play, and I don't have to pretend very much here, but let me play naive here.
Okay.
And just tell you. So the court cites this definition in, I think, Webster's Third.
Yes.
You know, which is a dictionary.
It is from the Merriam-Webster.
A sandwich is two thin pieces of bread, usually buttered with a thin layer. And then in parentheses, as of meat, cheese, or savory mixture spread between them.
Yes.
Okay. So that's that.
Yep.
Now, of course, for me, the dictionary means whatever I I guess it would be like command click or right click or use three fingers to tap on my computer and the definition pops up.
Yeah.
That to me is the dictionary.
Okay.
Right. I'm putting both hands up in the air as if I'm done, by the way, for this is the visual clue. But what it tells me, and I looked this up, and apparently what Apple is using, and I don't know what other platforms use, is the new Oxford American Dictionary.
Okay. Great.
And it defines it as one, an item of food consisting of two pieces of bread with meat, cheese, or other filling between them, eaten as a light meal. And then I think an example is a ham sandwich. But definition two is something that is constructed like or has the form of a sandwich.
See?
Which, you know, is a... the word bread, I looked that up too, is defined as a food made of flour, water, and a leavening agent such as yeast mixed together and baked. So the idea of unleavened bread would seem not to be in that definition. This is just looking at this particular dictionary.
Yeah, the fact that you would use the word unleavened to modify the word bread would indicate that usually bread is leavened.
Usually.
Are tortillas not leavened?
Yeah, but you wouldn't say like a non-bread Coca-Cola. Or a non-Coke based bread.
I'm trying to imagine the circumstances under which I would be moved to say. And you're right. It's an odd scenario.
It's an odd scenario, right? So the fact that you say unleavened bread indicates that there are some breads which are not leavened, but it may be somewhat unusual because you're having to
specify. Something about the word bread still makes sense, even though it isn't leavened bread.
Right. And I'll just throw this out there. In the Sabritas case, which the court distinguishes. Mm. This is the one where it comes up in the context of tariffs, which are taxes paid on imports,
at
right?
The
this
border,
was
yeah.
This was an import of tortilla products from Mexico into the United States, and the question is, should they be taxed as bread products or as other products, right? And that depends on your interpretation of here a statute which specifies these different categories.
Interesting. Okay.
And there the court said that of course tortillas are bread.
Mm.
and it used, it looked up dictionaries and including, I don't know if they, I actually don't have in my notes whether it was Webster's Third, but they cited the World Encyclopedia of Food, the OED, the Oxford English Dictionary, yep, the Dictionary of American Food and Drink.
Nice.
They looked up a number and they cited various articles. So this was a much more kind of a much farther reaching analysis of what people mean when they say bread. Mm-hmm. And the quote here is, let's see, I've got it right here. The court begins its analysis by noting that tortillas are unquestionably commonly and commercially accepted as bread in the United States. They don't just assert that. They use these citations to these various sources to back that up. And then they say, to contend that the common and commercial meaning of bread is limited to baked, leavened, or even unleavened products ignores the reality that flat fried, usually ethnic breads exist in the United States market and are generally accepted as forms of bread. And they see, it's really interesting. They say usually ethnic breads. It implies a certain kind of like, there's something politically interesting about the, about a battle over the use of the word bread, and to say something is not bread and is bread, yeah, it has these kind of ethnic or racial overtones to it. Kind
or
of interesting.
Or like, to imagine there is a, there are humans who are not ethnic. Like, well, there's a non-ethnic group of humans. It's, yeah. Yeah. There's a,
I think in the specialty food context, there, yes, are definitions about probably ethnic foods, which, yeah, for sure, you know, anyway. Yeah. Yeah.
Words are fascinating.
But then this court in Sabritas, this court in this case, the, PR,
yeah,
case, says, he characterizes it this way. Let me just read this to you. Let me, based on what I've read to you, you tell me whether you think this is fair. In Sabritas, the International Trade Court applied the commercial meaning rather than the ordinary meaning of bread to corn taco shells for purposes of levying tariffs. Here, the commercial meaning of bread is inapposite, where it is the ordinary meaning that is relevant when interpreting an unambiguous contractual term such as sandwiches.
What's the question?
The question is that a fair characterization of what the court said in Sabritas?
I think it is, the court mentions that it was done to make a tariff classification.
Yeah.
And that means we are in a context where people are importing things for sale.
Right.
And that is a commercial activity. Now, running a sandwich shop in a shopping mall is also a commercial activity.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, I don't know how much we've improved our clarity by making, you know, commercial, what was the commercial versus
ordinary. Let me look back at my commercial meaning. It's the ordinary meaning, they, okay, say.
Yeah. So I'm not sure how much oomph we're getting out of commercial, like as a,
right,
thing.
Right.
So yeah, I don't, I mean, it seems not unfair to characterize Sabritas that way. But to me, the word doing the work there is tariffs.
Yeah, I think
they not the word commercial.
And maybe this is unfair to spring on you without kind of, you should read the whole thing, I think.
Yeah, because I haven't
read it. But the Sabritas court like cites a wide range of materials, which I raise here. We're at the end of our conversation nearly, but I raise this to kind of cue up like how you might think of using dictionaries and other sources to fill in, right, the word. And the court in Sabritas, I think, is very focused on like, what do people in the United States mean when they say bread? It points to this like, non-exclusion of what they characterize as like flatbreads and especially ethnic flatbreads. My perspective was that maybe not a fair characterization exactly of what they did, but
rather than fair or unfair, I think
now just to be clear, the court is not bound by, it could have said the Sabritas court found that this was a kind of bread. We disagree because we think that this dictionary definition is clear and the parties needed to be clear that they wanted to go beyond it. Right. This is not a case.
Differently.
Yeah. But here they say, no, they might've been right. And we're right,
yeah,
because they were doing a different thing.
And here's the sense in which I think that captures something interesting, although I might've described it somewhat differently were I the one writing the opinion.
Yeah.
I think that a thing that the range of dictionaries can help you do, well, there are actually two things that they can help you do, and you wind up picking different dictionaries to do them, right? One is to get to become highly confident that you understand the full range of reasonable meanings for that word, the full range,
mm-hmm,
right? Including some you might not have been familiar with before you started. That would lead you toward things like, as they're called, unabridged dictionaries, that are produced with much effort and that take as their task making sure you've got the full range of meaning that this word can be proved to have in the usage of the people who speak the language, which is how you find it, right? You go right. Look at usage examples and you craft out of that a definition.
Books, magazines, the web these days, conversations, podcasts.
The important thing about the quote unabridged, it's those definitions are crafted to be comprehensive of the meaning of the word. That's one task. And dictionaries, certain kinds, can really help you do that. Here's another task that a dictionary can help you do, although you'd pick a very different dictionary, is it can help you focus on the most likely meaning in ordinary communication.
So if you heard someone say this word and you didn't have other context pointing you in a particular direction, right. What did they likely mean?
Yeah. And no reason to think they meant something out of the ordinary, right?
Right.
Now, those dictionaries in today's marketplace are usually called advanced learner's dictionaries.
Oh, I did.
They are an English language dictionary for someone for whom English is not their first language.
Ah.
Advanced learner. So they're not a beginner. They're an advanced learner. And what they're looking for and what these definitions are written to provide is the common, ordinary way people use that word. That is the thing you're likely to encounter, which as someone who isn't a native speaker of the language, you might not be familiar with. Right?
So would you consult that in this case if you were the judge?
I think it would have been a much better choice.
Than Webster's Third.
Than Webster's Third, because I think it's precisely because I think the question, and the court says this is the question, what's the ordinary meaning, right? So in other words, what's the typical meaning? That's how I hear ordinary or think about ordinary in a context like this, right?
But,
we're choosing a word to use together and we're giving no signs that we mean anything out of the ordinary, anything atypical, right? So I don't need to know the comprehensive range of all the things this might mean for the last three centuries. What I need to know is what do people who are talking this way today mean when they say that?
A judge who's...
Advanced learner dictionaries are perfect for that.
If we didn't use that, if a judge was just winging it, like, I think a sandwich means this. That would still, like, because the judge in many ways is representative, right? The judge is a member of the, and in fact, if this is a case in Northern Idaho,
right.
and the parties are Northern Idaho, they may have, you know, the judge may be actually a better indicator of what is likely meant by a particular word than any dictionary that's produced.
And to me, it's kind of a coin flip between, like, do I think it would have been better for the court to say, look, the ordinary meaning of sandwich is the following. That does not include burritos or tacos or quesadillas. Every person with an ounce of sense knows that. And we're done. Would I think that was better than, and I went and looked in Webster's Third New International Dictionary, which is just for the folks listening at home, the most commonly cited dictionary in court opinions in the United States, like by a country mile. State and federal. And I looked in Webster's Third New International. Here's what it said. I mean, have you really added anything? Because when you look in Webster's Third, depending on the word you're looking at, right, you could be looking at half a page of text about the meaning of a particular word.
Right.
Which parts of that big text do you pick?
I think it was Posner one time, maybe citing Easterbrook, you know, these, well-known kind of conservative judges, conservative-leaning judges in the 80s, 90s, and into today, but who said, kind of pushing back against a kind of like textual formalism, saying that dictionaries are mazes in which you can get lost. Because a dictionary is, you know, gives, I'm trying to figure out what a word means, and it gives me more words, right? And I might not know what they mean. So another way at this, I think about it this way. Maybe there are a lot of cases which are resolved by my thinking, something along the lines of this, if my family and friends sent me out to get sandwiches and I came back with a bunch of burritos, would they be justifiably mad at me?
Right.
And, you know, the famous is a hot dog a sandwich, you could do the same exercise.
Right.
I think they'd be mad at me.
Or
delightfully surprised, but surprised.
I think surprised is another way to interpret it, right?
But anger and condemnation may become naturally to me when I think about how my friends might react to what I do.
Families are all unhappy in their own special way. That is a helpful way to think about it. Although there too, I think there's a choice to be made about, is the interaction an interaction driven by making sure you've got a comprehensive sense of what that word could mean?
Right.
Or a targeted heartland sense of what that word could mean? Because mm-hmm. different reference materials are designed to help you do different, those right. two different things.
Well, I think maybe this, maybe we can end this way, unless you have something else you, nope. you're burning to bring up. But one of them is that whatever we do, we might get wrong. Right. In the sense that the parties may well have had a very good idea of what this meant at the beginning
yeah.
and are incentivized maybe to come up with other arguments in the course of litigation.
Sure.
And we may arrive at a definition which is not actually what the parties, not the definition we would have hoped to reach with good evidence and everything else.
Right.
This is true of all cases. You yeah. know, was somebody negligent? Did somebody commit a murder? Did some government official act in a certain way with a certain kind of mental state that was discriminatory or against some statute, right? All of these involve findings of facts and interpretations of what has happened, which might end up being wrong.
Yep.
And I clerked for a judge who I think one time told us, like, you know, maybe the most important job of judges is to make good guesses, or at least that's what you should try to do, because you're never going to have certainty in the, like, we don't know for sure what the parties meant by this. We don't know for sure. Maybe because it's conceptually not possible to know for sure what this word like really means.
Yeah.
Right. And so we just have to do our best to provide a sensible, justified reason that will end this fight in something other than war, right? Something other than violence between the parties, right? So we're going to say, here's how we're going to resolve this. This is what the state through the courts is going to order. And here are our reasons for it, right? And giving those reasons is important, but you know, we might be wrong. And that's why we have things like the burden of proof and the standard of proof and the standard of review on appeal, or we're trying to figure how certain do we need to be before we take this step. So I think that's one big point here is we might be wrong about this. And this is just our attempt to do what we want to do for the parties, for society in the best possible way, knowing that there's this uncertainty out there.
And yeah.
We may never be right. There was one other thing I wanted to mention. Now I forget what it was.
Hmm.
But this has gone long enough.
Okay.
And I think I'll tell the students, but you should know, not all of our weeks are going to have episodes that go on quite this long. It's somewhat front loaded. So, hopefully this was as delightful for people listening as it was for us. I somehow doubt it'll be quite as delightful because this was very delightful for me.
I enjoyed it tremendously.
Okay. All right, guys. We'll see you in class.